And then once you've got, you know, clients, you've got to do it. you've got to act on it. And that's when it becomes all real, and you're out there with a dog you don't know on a lead, wondering what on earth is going to happen next.
I'm Phil Hatterman, and this is Dog Words, presented by Rosie Fund. Today, author Kate McDougall tells us how she started London's number one dog walking agency. Our conversation is just as much fun as reading the book. So after you listen to this episode, click on the link in the description to go to Amazon Smile and buy London's number one dog walking agency, a memoir. If you use Amazon Smile, a portion of all eligible purchases goes to the charity of your choice. We thank you for choosing Rosie Fund. If you're new to Dog Words, in each episode we explore the world of dog care and companionship. We save each other is the motto of Rosie Fund, which simply means the more we do for dogs, the more they do for us, and they already do a lot. If you love dogs, you'll love Dog Words. We welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions, especially if you have an idea for a topic or guest. Go to the podcast page at rosiefund.org to share your thoughts. Please download, follow, rate, and most importantly, share Dog Words. You can donate to Rosie Fund on our website or Facebook page. You can also contribute by making a purchase from the store on our website, buying a t-shirt at bonfire.com, or buying our note cards and shirts on barkyours.com. Links are in the description. Your donations and purchases help fund the Rosie Life Starter Kits that make sure these senior and harder-to-adopt dogs have some of the items they'll need in their forever home. Any donation amount is greatly appreciated, but here are some popular levels. $30 provides a collar and leash for a Rosie Life Starter Kit dog, and $100 covers their entire kit. Please follow Rosie Fund on social media. Subscribe to the free Rosie Fund YouTube channel that offers great videos of Rosie, Peaches, and shelter dogs looking for their forever home. Even if you aren't looking for a dog, watching and sharing the videos helps give these dogs much-needed exposure. Stay tuned for this episode's closing comments for an update on Peaches Delight. Next time on Dog Words, Kim Ellis Shaw tells us how Synergy Services helps pets and people. The mission of Rosie Fund is to provide humans with the resources and education they need to give senior and harder to adopt dogs a better life. We thank you for joining our mission. Today on Dog Words, joining us from Oxfordshire in the UK is Kate McDougall. Welcome to Dog Words, Kate.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Kate is the author of London's number one dog walking agency, a memoir. I loved this book. I was a little slow getting into it because I am a small business owner. I have a general consulting firm with media, and then our foundation is a small foundation, so running that. And there were some frustrations in reading the book, because I would see you making the same mistakes I had made.
That's
like,
so
no, Kate, no. But I stuck with it, and it is so worth it. Any issues I had with getting rolling in the book had nothing to do with you or your writing or the content. They were my issues.
That is so interesting. You'll have to tell me what those concerns were in a minute.
Well, we will get to that, and the book will be linked in the description if you want to buy it through Kate's website, or also the link for Amazon Smile if you want to buy it and have a portion of your purchase go to supporting a charity. It could be Rosie Fund. We would love that. But if it supports any charity, that is a great way to make your purchase. And there will be a link to katemcdougallwrites.com. That will also be in the description. You were not always an author. So it's not like you'd been just cranking out books and then dropped London's number one dog walking agency. You kind of fell into the dog walking agency and the book and everything. Tell us how this all got started.
So I think I've always been a writer, actually. I think it's probably something I just didn't really recognize in myself because I got distracted by other things, other careers, and just life in general. I did a degree in art history at Edinburgh University in Scotland, which was a 4-year master's degree. And from that, I ended up getting a job at Sotheby's, which is quite a hard thing to do. It's a very competitive place to work because it's so well known and well respected. And I got a job there in the furniture department, which is a kind of the general antique side of the business. So furniture, but also works of art. So, you know, little sculptures, also things like rugs and all sorts of stuff. It was a wonderful place to work in many ways, a fascinating place to work. You get the privilege to be around all these amazing works of art and also come across some fascinating people. But it wasn't really for me. I was finding it both frustrating because I wasn't really using my brain enough, and challenging in that I was just not suited to be around precious works of art. I was just a bit clumsy. So the catalyst for me leaving was breaking two porcelain pigeons, which were very ugly and actually weren't worth very much money. So it wasn't a terrible disaster.
You might have been doing the world a favor.
Yes, exactly. And I think the lady that owned them, she ended up getting a nice insurance payout. It was actually, they would never have sold at Sotheby's otherwise. But yes, I was sort of, you know, treading water there. Wasn't really enjoying it. And around the same time, I happened to meet somebody in the park who was looking after a dog for a well-known British actress. She was on stage at the time, and this guy was looking after the dog. And he said, "Yes, I'm the dog walker." And I thought, gosh, I didn't think people did that here. Now, I know that people did it in the US, been doing it from back to the 60s, I believe, from doing some research.
And what time frame are we talking about here where you had this encounter?
So this is 2004, yeah.
And dog walking has changed a lot since 2004. There's been dog walkers, as you indicated, way back to the 60s.
Yeah.
But even in 2004, people weren't treating their dogs the way they are now. That was kind of right in the middle of the shift from it being a pet to being a part of the family.
Yeah, I apologize. It was 2006. I'm getting confused. 2006.
Well, that's entirely different then. Never mind. I take back.
Same thing.
But yeah.
It was that. So what was there was no dog walking in the UK, really. And we were on the cusp of dogs being the sort of fur babies, you know, the sort of whole thing of the dog being, you know, the key member of the household. And I think this is probably slightly more of a uniquely British thing, where we are very much a kind of nation of, we are big dog lovers, but being British, there's a sort of sensibility there, a sort of, you know, you mustn't overindulge. And
who do you think you are paying someone to walk your dog?
Exactly. Yeah. The dog is just a dog. It just sits there and it's fine. Yeah, Why are you worrying about it? My mother is exactly that person. She'd be like, "It's just the dog. You know, why are you getting upset about it?" And it's not that we as in the royal we, the British we. We don't love dogs. We're a massive dog loving country. But I think it took us a while to sort of feel like we were allowed to be sort of soppy about them and to show our affection in a sort of more overt way.
It's the stereotype of the stiff upper lip that Americans associate with Brits.
Completely. And I think now we're a bit more open about sort of indulging them and buying them sweaters and, you know, being all lovey-dovey with them, which is, we were all doing secretly, but now we're a bit more open about it. So 2006, no one was really doing dog walking, which made my huge career shift quite confusing to a lot of people, particularly my family and friends and, basically everybody.
So it's not like there's a Starbucks on every corner and you go, "Well, maybe I should open a coffee shop. People seem to this."
Exactly.
Like, nobody's doing dog walking.
No, what they're like, "But dog walking, what does that mean?" Even just the words, they were like, what do you mean? What is that? And you say, "Well, I walk dogs for people." Like, "What do you mean?"
are the dogs incapable of walking themselves? Are these, physically challenged dogs that you manipulating their legs for them?
You literally have to explain it to them. I turn up to their house and I take their dog for a walk and I get paid for that. I mean, that was exactly, I had to explain it like it was in very, black and white terms. That's, I think, it was particularly confusing to people. And I think that helped me sort of throw myself into it without much thought and think, well, what's the worst that can happen? I don't really know what I'm doing, but you know, it's not an established, I'm not an established thing. I'm just going to go and see what happens.
Yeah, it's impossible to do it wrong.
Yes, exactly. There's no guide on this. I'm just, you know, how hard can it be? Also, I'm just going to, as I'm describing to people, I'm just going to be walking the dog. And of course, that's, you know, a tiny fraction of running a business, you know, that is customer facing and customer service based in a capital city where, you know, you are coming across all kinds of different people with all their, you know, weird and wonderful requests and demands. And I was definitely naive, I would say, was going into it. But I do want to, as I say in the book, I do honestly think that was, that actually helped. I think if I'd known, I would never have done it.
That's, I think, true of a lot of entrepreneurial efforts or risks of any kind. You need to make an honest assessment of what are my resources, what are my opportunities, what am I capable of, is the gain worth the risk? But there's almost always enough mystery that if you knew exactly what the pain points were going to be and what you'd have to overcome, I don't think I want to do that. That's not worth it. But once you're in the middle of it, well, let's keep going forward. It's like swimming across a river. Like, this is a lot harder than I thought, but I'm halfway across the river. Why? I can drown or I can turn back. I might as well keep swimming.
Exactly. And I think, you know, a lot of life decisions we go into without fully knowing, and luckily that it works out, or, you know, but we wouldn't make these life-changing decisions and changes in our life if we knew all the facts. I think going into it a little bit blind is a good thing. I mean, relationships and, I don't know, purchases you make. I mean, I think, you know, there's a little bit of mystery to a lot of things. And I think that's how it should be.
If you had all the facts, you would never act, because you're never going to get all the facts. You're going to keep gathering data and you're never going to take action.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So the extraordinarily lucky thing for me was that 2006, setting up the business, setting up the website, which was literally all I did, was create a website with the help of a friend. It was exactly on that time where people were starting to think about getting someone to walk their dogs. How that sort of shift happened, I really don't know. But immediately the phone started ringing. There was a need for it. And I think I'd like to say that I had some sort of insight into what was going to happen, but I really didn't. It was pure luck. And then once you've got, you know, clients, you've got to do it. you've got to act on it. And that's when it becomes all real. And you're out there with a dog you don't know on a lead, wondering what on earth is going to happen next.
Well, now we are treading into the waters that were making me have flashbacks.
Yes.
Through certainly the beginning of the book and the first part of the book. You are just saying yes to everything and everyone.
Yes.
And part of being a leader, and I think part of being sane and healthy, is knowing when to say no.
Yes.
And there's a sweet spot there. You can say no to everything, which goes back to what we were just discussing. It's like, well, I don't have enough information. That seems too risky. I don't want to take a chance. No, 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 no. But there's also saying yes to everything, and then you can't do everything, or you get in over your head.
Yeah.
But the risk of saying yes often is better than the risk that is associated with saying no.
Yes.
You learn very little from saying no.
Yeah.
At least if you say yes and it goes south on you, you've learned something, either to say no to that in the future or to say yes, but and handle it differently. And you say yes pretty much throughout the book until you don't.
Yeah. And I'm still not very good at saying no. Maybe you are just a person that says yes, or you're a person that says no. I'm definitely more of the yes person than I am the no. And I think that's a really important lesson to learn in life, is when to say no. Sometimes I think I've got there a bit, but a lot of the time, no.
If you were to ask me what I'm good at, saying no would be toward the top of the list.
That's brilliant. And does it always feel good to say no?
No. Well, aren't I clever? No, it doesn't always feel good to say no.
But is it
but sometimes it feels right to say no.
Yes. Okay.
And a lot of times that's when I know it was the right thing, because this is not an emotional decision, but based on the information I have, it's no. And so if a friend asks me to do something that I know I will not give them the help they need, I can't guarantee I'm available that day or that I have the resources to help you, even though I want to help them.
Yeah.
I'm going to say no, so that you can get someone you can rely on to execute this task for you, to be there for you, whether it's as a friend or as a colleague. But then there's times where I will be upfront and say, I'm going to help you with this, but here are my limitations. And if you can live with that, that's my qualified yes. Yeah. But a lot of times it's easier to say no.
That sounds incredibly sensible. I need to write this down.
Well,
future reference.
I'll send you a link to the podcast once it's up.
Perfect.
You don't have to write it down.
I think there's more yeses when you're younger than there are no's. I mean, I was unbelievably enthusiastic at the beginning.
And that certainly comes across in the book.
Yeah. And I think, you know, having a client say, I want you to walk my dog, or I want to use your service, or I want to buy for you, whatever that business is, at the beginning is incredibly addictive, mm-hmm. you know, because it feels good to be recognized and to feel like what you're doing is making people happy and it works. So you see saying yes as a validation of what mm-hmm. you're doing without thinking of the logistics or the consequences or how it's all going to work practically, which is exactly what happened. Yeah.
And it's easy to empathize with you as a character in this book. If I'm watching a movie and people are making questionable choices, but I don't empathize with the character, I'm out. I'm moving on to a different movie. But here, we want things to go well for you because you are trying hard. You are enthusiastic. You have the best of motivations. You're not just self-absorbed and there's naivete, but not trying to think of the right word for this. It could be a narcissistic thing where, yes, everything for me, I deserve all of this. That it doesn't come across as that. It comes across as I'm trying to figure this out, and I think I'm smart enough, talented enough to figure this out. So I'm just going to keep moving forward until I do.
Yeah, it is literally that sort of one step at a time, just putting one step in front of the other. But I think that's something that, you know, we can all relate to, particularly that time, you know, in our 20s, 30s, where we're still trying to find our feet and figure out what we want to do in life and where our talents lie and what job am I going to have that's going to make me happy and is going to be something that can sustain me financially and is going to be rewarding.
And well, you talked about your educational background and where you ended up. For some people, that's the dream. You've gotten your degree, your certification, and I've got a nice paying job that others would envy. To walk away from that would be unthinkable for a lot of people, because this was the goal. This was what you're supposed to do. And your mother certainly had that perspective.
Yes.
And if you're 25, 28, 30, you feel like everything I've done up to this point was to get me here. And if I pivot, the last 20, 30 years have been a waste.
Yes.
I don't want to start over. And even if you don't consciously think of that, there has to be a part of you in your subconscious that's saying, you don't want to waste another 20, 30 years, because that's what it might take to get to this again. Don't give this up.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think following that sort of set path of school and then university, and when I went to Edinburgh University, which is one of the oldest universities in the United Kingdom and a beautiful place to be and to study, it was free. I didn't have to pay for that education at all. It was covered by the government at that point. Now is not the case here at all. Such an enormous, enormous privilege. And yes, getting the job at Sotheby's, these are all incredible things and are, you know, far more than a lot of people will ever have. And there's something that I was sort of felt like, you know, I don't want to come across like as ungrateful for any of any of those opportunities, because they are fantastic. But there was something in me, I just wasn't happy and settled. And that is the bit of me, which I now know where I am now, being a writer, was that creative urge in me, which was so strong. And I didn't have the confidence to say, or to maybe just to recognize in myself that I needed to go and do something original and creative.
And maybe a little bit of guilt.
Yeah.
I've gotten all this. I had this privilege of that education and this job. Who am I to say this isn't absolutely good enough for me?
Yeah, absolutely. And the bit about the business that I really loved and that really sort of satisfied me was the creative side of it. It was the creation of the business and the kind of the growth of it, building something, creating it. That was what I really loved. And when it came to the point where I was mainly sort of apologizing to very wealthy Londoners for their dog having a bit of mud on them or whatever, that was the point where I was like, this isn't fulfilling what I thought it was going to anymore. And that's when I sort of realized I probably needed to hand over. It coincided luckily with having kids and stuff. So it became like it made sense in, you know, in sort of practical terms. But at the time I was enjoying it, and I wasn't old enough or I wasn't experienced enough to recognize in myself what bits of me were being fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And I can look back on that now and say, yes, it was the creative side of it that I really liked. People go, oh, you're an entrepreneur. What's your next business? I'm thinking, no, I'm really not at all. I haven't got a clue. Like, my accountant like has her head in her hands when she talks to me, because she has to explain like net and turnover, you know, and I'm just sitting there going, oh, I don't understand any of this. It just wasn't that part. Those parts of it were not at all interesting to me.
The words that she's saying don't make sense, but the look on her face is what's telling you, okay, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Okay, this one might be a bad thing.
Exactly.
Based on her scowl. Oh, she's smiling. I did something good.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I do think I was just really lucky. You know, I can be proud and say I created a really successful business, which is still going now in London. But actually, there was a lot of luck in that. A lot of luck, the timing. And also just when you stick at something and you work hard at it, I've always had a very strong work ethic. And I'm a people pleaser. So I wanted the customers to be happy. So those two things together, you know, and hard work means that, you know, the business is going to do all right. But yeah, I'm definitely not a born businesswoman.
You keep referencing luck. There's a sort of a truism that basketball coaches and perhaps other coaches use variations of this, which is you miss every shot that you don't take.
Yes.
And maybe you get a lucky bounce and the ball goes in off of the backboard or the back of the rim or something, but you put yourself in the position to take advantage of that luck.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not very good at giving myself credit, but.
Well, then I will do it. You deserve some credit, Kate.
Thank you. It's a very British thing. It's a very British thing. It's going to go, oh no, don't give me any praise. Well, we're very bad at that as a nation, I think.
A bit of advice that I give people who talk to me about how could you be self-employed and run your own business and, you know, all the risks. And well, part of it is having a very supportive spouse.
Yeah.
As the book certainly suggests you do as well. So I don't know if you took artistic license there accurate. So that is a huge part of it. And balancing that with being selfish, you have to be a little bit selfish.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've never thought of it that way. In what way would you say?
You have to take care of yourself. The analogy I use is when you're on an airplane and they're giving the safety briefing before you take off, and they say, if the oxygen mask drops down, put it on yourself before you put it on your child or whoever's next to you. Because if you don't, and you're scrambling around with them and you don't have enough oxygen then you can't help them. You can't help anybody. So you have to take care of yourself first before you can help anyone else. It's a healthy selfishness.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a brilliant analogy. I have a very, very supportive, very patient husband who didn't like dogs at all. And now we have two, possibly nearly three dogs and three children. And he's the kind of man that would just like to have a little sit down in a room on his own for the rest of his life and not have to deal with anybody. And we have a busy household. And at the time, we were both sort of finding our feet in life and in London and figuring out how to be adults. And rather than saying, which most of everybody else did, say, what are you doing? What is this job you're doing? What is this business? He just never thought it was a crazy idea. He only was ever encouraging and supportive. And even when I said, let's get our own dog, and he was just like, no, I really don't want a dog. He still went with it, and now he absolutely loves dogs. But
he seems like the ultimate team player. He'll tell you what his objections are. It's like, I disagree with that. That seems like a terrible idea. Why are you doing that?
Yeah.
But then once you make the decision, it's like, all right, then how can I help you with this?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That is exactly
And that's what you want. You don't want someone who's just going along because I don't want to rock the boat. You want to know what they genuinely think. But you also want to know you can count on them.
Yeah.
And he certainly seemed to exhibit those traits.
Yeah, he does. He does all the time. He's incredibly smart and very, very funny and very, very supportive. I think he knows deep down that I'm really stubborn. And if I don't get, if he says no to me, I might just do it anyway. Or, you know, he's also very easygoing. So a lot of the time he doesn't really mind either way. And it's probably just easier to go, okay, get the third dog, or, oh God, let's have another baby then, or whatever it is.
If this will back to my tea.
Yeah, exactly.
The answer
Can I just have a sit down first and have a cup of tea? Yeah, I mean, gosh, I think our partners are so crucial in all of this. And, you know, it took a long while of me writing before I made any money doing it. You know, I was doing it on the side while having children and figuring out what I was doing. And, you know, he supported me all through that as well. And rather than saying, you need to go and get a job, he let me kind of take that time to write the book, which is another amazing thing, really, because we're nothing without, I mean, that support, really, are we? I mean, I think achieving in business or achieving in the arts, whatever it is, it really is impossible without support from someone, whether that's friends or family or whoever it is.
So not only is it valuable for our listeners to understand your tenacity, your drive, your good fortune, but also you can be that support for somebody else. It's so valuable. Yeah. Even if they don't acknowledge it, they may not even be aware of it. Just be that person.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's a really lovely thing to say. Yeah, absolutely. I find that I'm one of the things I get most joy out of my life is being a good friend to people and to help people and encourage them with what they're doing. And once you've been through sort of struggles yourself or you've got over certain obstacles, you're in a much better position to be able to support other people.
Mm-hmm. Even if it's just listening, not even specific advice. I can't tell you whether to take this deal or not take this deal, but I can help you think it through. I can let you talk through it. Or maybe they're not even looking for advice. They just need to vent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Being that for someone, being there for someone is so valuable.
Oh God, yeah, absolutely.
The structure of the book, London's number one dog walking agency, a memoir, is very engaging because each chapter, I'm just going to open up at random. For instance, there's a chapter about halfway through, Zeus, Rhodesian Ridgeback, 1, Covent Garden, September 2008, number of dogs walked, 55. So each chapter starts with that little update on where you're at in your journey with the dog walking agency.
Yes.
We get to meet many dogs and many interesting characters.
Yes.
And follow part of their journey in addition to following your journey.
Yeah. So some of the dog's story goes right the way through the book. So that's why it'll say if it has the dog's name, and then it'll say part one, part two, mm-hmm. part three. And some of them are just standalone chapters. So some of the dogs just feature once, but they kind of help to sort of reflect back on something that was going on in my life at the time. Yeah, so the dog that probably has the most chapters is my own dog, Mabel.
Yes,
who
meet Mabel.
Appears sort of about a quarter of the way through the book, I guess, and then goes right through to the end. She's in the next room. She's nearly 14 now.
Spoiler alert, Kate gets a dog.
Yeah, oh yeah, sorry. Mabel, yeah, she's a Jack Russell. The number of dogs walked was an idea I had working through with the editors when we were doing the edits for the book, to just to kind of keep a running tally of what's going on. I think it's hard to, well, I think they wanted it to be sort of make it very clear the sort of scale of the business and the sort of the growth, but also the dip that comes with the recession and the banking crisis in 2008, where I nearly basically lost pretty much all of my clients in one go, and then how I built that back up again. And I just think it's, you know, I still find it staggering looking at some of these numbers. I think, my God, how on earth did
I
manage
this?
People? What on earth was I thinking? 92 dogs at what, you know, you're like, oh my goodness me.
Well, it's kind of like watching the movie The Martian with Matt Damon. Oh, it's very good. So sidebar, everyone, you need to see The Martian starring Matt Damon, where it's an expedition to Mars and a storm is coming that's going to wipe out the little research station that they've set up, and he can't make it back to the escape vehicle in time, and they leave him behind. They think everyone who didn't make it to the escape vehicle has died.
Yeah.
But Matt Damon's character doesn't.
Because
he's Matt Damon. And that would be a terrible Matt Damon movie if shortly after the opening credits, he's gone. So the producers had the good sense to let his character live.
Yeah.
And he uses his scientific background and cleverness to survive on Mars by himself, while the people back on Earth and the people in the escape vehicle on their way back to Earth finally find out he survived. He's sending transmissions. How do we get back to him? But there's sort of time codes that track so that it doesn't seem like this all happened in 2 hours. It's like this took months. And you,
months. And, oh, wow.
And
okay.
So it's the same sort of thread for you to hold on to in the book, seeing the number of dogs walked. I think that would be better than a time stamp.
Yes.
Which was perfect for The Martian, but it's the same sort of thing to give the audience a way to track the time, the growth, the evolution of this, and the scale of what is happening.
Yeah. I mean, if you say, you know, 97 dogs or whatever, that's a lot of dogs. That's a lot of dogs. And I think there's a bit in the book where I talk about sort of really can't really grasp their numbers when they get big, because if you do and you think about it, you kind of think, oh my, you know, you panic slightly. Mm-hmm. Where are they all? What are they doing? Oh my God, there's so many dogs. Ah, so it's better not to think about it too much, because I think, you know, our brains really can't compute that number of dogs running around London. Yeah. I mean, I think it's fascinating. I think it's from a business perspective, that sort of the growth is fascinating, really, the kind of how it scales up quite quickly, really. Yeah.
And you just mentioned running around London. I've been to London and I enjoyed the mentions of the different places and picturing. I was like, oh yeah, I was there, I saw that. Even if you have been to London, but certainly if you haven't, save a map on your phone or on your computer of London, or you can still buy maps on your wall.
They do exist, yes.
It's kind of like reading The Hobbit or The Lord of the Rings and following the map that's inside the flyleaf of, okay, here's where they're at.
I asked the publishers, I really wanted a map.
That, oh, that would have been great.
Cover, because I don't think it's clear even to British people, even possibly to Londoners. London is huge, and it's sort of a number of little villages, really, kind of all packed onto each other. Mm-hmm. If you live in southwest London, say in Fulham or in Wandsworth or Putney, you really probably would never go to northeast London. You know, it's vast, and everything you need will be in your little area. And so I think it's quite hard. I really wanted a visual image because it's a sort of the scale of where all these people are across London, mm-hmm. but also just the glory and the wonder of London is such a wonderful city, and it is filled with huge parks, which is amazing. My only real reference for the US is New York, which has one vast park, but then lots of little small ones. Mm-hmm. But London is filled with huge, huge green spaces, which is fantastic. But a lot of them are quite far away from each other. And I think that was one of the things I wanted to sort of illustrate. And I'm not sure whether it successfully came across through just the words themselves, but the sort of scale of the business in terms of where all these people are, they're quite spaced out.
Well, it's not a deal breaker on whether or not you will enjoy the book if you have the map or not, but it's just, I think, would add to the experience even more.
Yes.
Kind of like watching a movie in your home or on the theater. You'll enjoy it both places, but the theater experience, this would give you the theater experience. I'm going to tell you how to run your website, Kate. You need to add a button that is a link to the London's number one dog walking agency, a map.
That's such a good idea. Brilliant. Right. I'm on it.
Yeah. And there's a simple way to do it where this is just a link to a map of London. And then mm-hmm. maybe if you find somebody who can make it more interactive, that you can click on, this is for chapter one, or you click on a dot and it takes you to, this is where that dog lives. And
I love that idea.
That would be really cool. So I'm going to keep following your website waiting for that. And if you wouldn't mind shooting me an email once that's up and running.
I had in my mind, I picked it exactly what I wanted it to look like, sort of beautifully illustrated. And then you would have, say, you obviously wouldn't have all the London landmarks, but you might have, say, Big Ben, and then you might have Buckingham Palace, just to show, you know, kind of
relative locations.
Yeah. With little dogs, obviously, in the map as well. But
instead of dots, it's a dog. So like here's a Rhodesian Ridgeback, little icon for where he's at. And
exactly.
That would be great. Because I'm also picturing the Winnie the Pooh books. In the five, they had the 100-acre wood.
But that's exactly the reference I gave them, is the 100-acre wood, which was Winnie the Pooh is one of my favorite childhood books. And I, actually, any book that had a map in the front cover, I loved those books. I would always be looking back at the map. There's something about having that visual guide that is really captures your imagination, mm-hmm. I think, as a child particularly, but also as an adult, obviously.
Well, listeners, don't wait for the map, because that's not something you can just turn around overnight. Give Kate some time to do that. Go ahead and read the book, and then you can read it again.
Yes, exactly.
With that map. You can get London's number one dog walking agency, a memoir by Kate McDougall, is linked in the description. Her website, katemcdougallwrites.com, is linked in the description. And the website has beautiful pictures and your blogs.
It's not as updated as I'd like it to be, because I'm busily writing book number two.
Well, that was my next question. Is book number two coming? So obviously the answer is yes.
Book number two is coming. It's fiction. It's not about dogs, which is thrilling and terrifying at the same time. I've never written fiction before. Such an amazing privilege to have been asked by my publishers to write a fiction book. And I'm absolutely loving it. I'm about halfway through. It's set where I live, which is the Cotswolds in England, which is the most beautiful area. What the reference, the Cotswolds is sort of very picturesque, quaint.
I do. I read a lot of British literature. So yes, I'm familiar.
Perfect. Yeah. And it's about a family, slightly eccentric family, and two sisters who have to try and help reform their slightly naughty father. So that's what I'm working on at the minute. And it's due in the summer. So I'm very slack on my website.
We will allow it if you promise to come back when that book comes out, even if it's not about dogs. We would love to have you back when that is released.
So love to do that. And the first book is in development at the minute for television, which is exciting. So,
A way that I was going to recommend this book is it's not a mile-a-minute thriller. This is not a Jack Reacher novel.
There's no Matt Damon.
Yeah. But if you like The Detectorists,
it's exactly it, yes.
You will love this book.
Yes.
And I was even thinking, if this is serialized for television,
yes,
that would be exactly the feel that I would be expecting.
Yes. Well, I can't comment on the feel, how it's going to be. I can't even say any names of who's involved, but it's
so you can't tell me that Mackenzie Crook is going to play Tom? That would
That's
be perfect.
Perfect casting. No, I can't tell you anything. It's the script is in development at the minute. Yeah, it's very exciting. So I will keep you posted.
And we'll definitely have you back for that.
Yeah, so that's exciting. That's hopefully going ahead quite soon, and I'll let you know. But yeah, I think as we're talking about visual imagery of it, I think the kind of Londonness of it is going to be, you know, very key, making London look very pretty and lovely, which of course it is.
Are you at all nervous about casting? Like, are you telling them, I don't know if Emily Blunt is available? I would love to be played by Emily Blunt. And then you hear back that, we were leaning more towards someone a little more elderly and craggy.
I would trust whoever's opinion on it. No, I'm not nervous at all. It's just very exciting. And I there's not much to know at the minute, but as soon as I have any more information and I'm allowed to tell you, I will let you know.
Okay, I am counting on it. Kate, thank you so much for not just being a guest on Dog Words, but for writing this delightful book. Again, it's linked in the description. Check out London's number one dog walking agency, a memoir by Kate McDougall.
Thank you for having me. It's been such an honor. Thank you.
I'm Phil Hatterman, and you've been listening to Dog Words, presented by Rosie Fund. Stay tuned for an update on Peach's Delight. Thank you to Kate McDougall for joining us today. A link to her website, katemcdougallwrites.com, is in the description, along with a link to buy London's number one dog walking agency, a memoir, on Amazon Smile. A portion of the proceeds from all eligible Amazon Smile purchases goes to the charity of your choice. We are grateful if you choose Rosie Fund. Next time on Dog Words, Kim Ellis Shaw tells us how Synergy Services is helping pets and people in Kansas City and piloting a program to roll out nationwide. A big thank you to alternative string duo The Wires, featuring cellist Sasha Groshong and violinist Laurel Morgan Parks, for playing the wonderful music you've heard on today's and previous episodes of Dog Words. Supporting The Wires supports our mission. Learn more about The Wires, including their concert schedule, at thewires.info and download their music on iTunes. Check out fiddlelife.com and learn to play fiddle and cello fiddle online from Laurel and Sasha, even if you've never played before. And don't forget to join Laurel and Sasha as they explore new music and delve into the inspiration behind each work as hosts of Sound Currents on 91.9 Classical KC. Click on the Sound Currents link in the description for more information. Donate to Rosie Fund on our website or Facebook page. You can also contribute by making a purchase from our website store, buying a t-shirt at bonfire.com, or putting some of our merch in your cart when you shop at Bark Yours. Links are in the description. Your donations help fund the Rosie Life Starter Kits that make sure these senior and harder-to-adopt dogs have some of the items they'll need in their forever home. As always, please download, rate, and share Dog Words. This helps us with sponsorships, then Rosie Fund can help more dogs. Support Rosie Fund by following us on social media, and please subscribe to the free Rosie Fund YouTube channel. Our latest post features a wonderful KC Pet Project dog looking for a forever home. Send us your comments, questions, and suggestions at rosiefund.org and let us know if you would like to be a sponsor or a guest of the Dog Words podcast. And now for the Peaches update. If you've already listened to episode 249, our interview with the founders of Honey Homekeepers, Bethany Spilde and Janessa Dolphin, you know in the episode's closing comments, I gave an update on Peaches Delight. For Rosie Fund, and personally, my wife Dawn and I have chosen 2022 as the year of Peaches Delight, because this will be her last year with us. She's been diagnosed with bladder cancer and has started chemo treatments. The first round was last week, and we're very pleased with the way she responded. We don't know what it means for reducing the cancer or keeping it from metastasizing. It'll probably take a few more treatments to know that. But what we do know is that she really didn't exhibit side effects of any severity. Or if she did, she certainly didn't let us know. If anything, her appetite was a little more enthusiastic than usual. That may just be a coincidence. Or it may be that she's getting a lot more rice and chicken with her kibble. She's always like that. The day this episode posts, she'll be getting blood work done to help the doctors evaluate how her body is responding to the chemotherapy and if it might be a good idea to put her on medication for her hyperparathyroidism. Right now, the focus is on treating the bladder cancer, isolating that variable since that is the most critical issue, and then possibly expanding to treatment of the hyperparathyroidism. We'll be letting you know how we're celebrating Peach's Delight. If you have any ideas for us, let us know. As always, a donation to Rosie Fund is welcome, along with the other ways that I've mentioned you can support Rosie Fund, but also just celebrating the pets and people that you love. Your donation to Rosie Fund does not help with Peach's treatment. We're taking care of that ourselves. That is not the mission of our 501c3, and that would probably be illegal. All donations to Rosie Fund and purchases from Rosie Fund affiliates still support our mission to help senior and harder-to-adopt dogs like Rosie and Peaches find their forever home. For more updates on Peaches, keep listening to Dog Words, and of course, follow us on social media, in particular, Rosie Fund's Facebook page. Thank you for listening, and remember, we save each other.